Welcome, listeners, to time for an awakening on Black Talk Radio Network, new media for the new millennia. This is a history and current events program from a cultural perspective. We find this program necessary because Hosea 4:6 states, "My people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge." But we as a people can turn this around. Proverbs 4:7 states, "Wisdom is the principal thing. Therefore, get wisdom. And with all thy getting, get an understanding." Again, welcome to the program this evening with your hosts, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. The number to reach us to join the conversation this evening is 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We're streaming live at several locations. You can go to timeforanawakening.com, which is the homepage, and catch the live stream from that location. You can go to www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. Again, that's www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening and catch the live stream there also. You can go to ourradionetwork.com. Again, that's ourradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. They broadcast out of the Black Belt and catch the live stream there. Or you can download TuneIn to any of your handheld devices. TuneIn is a free app. And in that TuneIn search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening. There you'll see the icon, and you can stream the program live, even into your car if you have the Bluetooth capabilities or the auxiliary connection. Again, that's Time for an Awakening radio program with the live stream on the TuneIn app. Drop us an email at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Again, that's timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Time for an Awakening also has a fan page on Facebook. In that Facebook search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening radio program. There you'll always see interesting content being posted daily. And do me a favor before you leave that page, just hit that like button. That's Time for an Awakening radio program with the fan page on Facebook, and Time for an Awakening media is there also. Always full of the latest podcasts of the various programs on Time for an Awakening, interesting articles that you can read, download at later times and share with your friends. Also, check out the Time for an Awakening Marketplace and our partnership with the B.B. Toomey. You can look on there, and there's a lot of different things that you can purchase from the marketplace. Language classes, education classes, economics courses, social system and health courses, hosted by various professors from the diaspora and from the continent. So check it out. In our partnership with the B.B. Toomey on Time for an Awakening Media. Make that one of your favorites. Put that in your address bar. That's timeforanawakening.com. Timeforanawakening.com will take you straight to Time for an Awakening Media. Tonight, we're scheduled to have special guests joining us, and they're waiting for us on the line. Mr. Bia Bethay is an international business senior at the University of Texas at Austin. Ms. Bethay and her team is there in Ghana doing a research project on colorism, and specifically the topic of skin bleaching in the country of Ghana and on the continent period, but they're focusing in on Ghana, and they'll be with us to continue this conversation to talk about their work, their group, and the project that they're doing. We'll be right back to get the program started after a brief word from our sponsors.
Mr. Moderator, our distinguished guests, brothers and sisters, our friends and our enemies. Everybody is here.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
Not a Wu-Tang-a. All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency and business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Years
before
now
your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Overworked? Suffering with an underperforming company, headache customer, staff, or vendors? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? We turned a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one transformation created for entrepreneurs like you in various industries around the country. Not what you're used to from accounting and business consulting? Well, welcome to New Business Solutions. If you're ready to go beyond advising, coaching, and training and get implemented results, call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions apply the best comprehensive administrative, accounting, operations, human resources, management, sales, and marketing to help you actualize your vision for yourself and your company. From anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072. Spelled new as in numerous on your device right now. Book your free consultation at newbusinesssolutions.com.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
From antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening. With your host, Brother Elliot. Sundays, 7 p.m., Fridays at 8 p.m. for podcasting or live program scheduling. Hit us up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. And before we get started with our program this evening, I want to welcome in my co-host, Philadelphia activist and tour guide at the African American Museum. Here in Philadelphia at 7th and Arch Street, Brother Richard is with us. Brother Richard.
Yes, sir, Brother Elliot.
How are you, sir?
I'm doing fine, just winding up. It's been an eventful weekend. In Philadelphia, you got the Black Star Film Festival that's been going on this weekend. And then you had Black Independence Day. You know, we attended the pre-networking with Dr.
Carlton Jones.
Carlton Jones. Mm-hmm. And then I went to I didn't jump, but I was out there with the Manifest Festival last night, and then wound up doing a walking tour of Black Philadelphia. Just walked in from it. So Wow. Been very eventful and looking forward to this topic here is so timely, in dealing with identity and culture and how we view ourselves. Still, people are dealing with this subject around bleaching cream.
I'm glad I was able to attend the meet and greet on Friday because I knew it would be difficult for me to get over to the parade and celebration on Saturday. Meant some, a lot of the folks there, some of the organizers, Brother Oba, the Minister of Confrontation, Mama Pam Africa, and it was good to see a lot of the people there. And I know the actual event was great. We did try to, because they wanted an address from somebody from Encobra, and Brother Ari, who is the male co-chair, was in out of the country at the time. So the female, one of the female co-chairs was there, and she addressed the audience. I think she was scheduled to speak at 5:30 to give the audience an overview of what's been going on in reference to the conversation around reparations. And then there was a ton of other speakers there. So I know, and I talked with Brother Khalid Rahim of the New African Independence Party. And he told me he was leaving town immediately after the event was over, which I think his transportation was scheduled for 8. But I'll get the hold of him because I kind of want to continue some of the dialogue with him. He's been networking almost constantly since he's been on the program with other groups, the group down in Maryland. He's been here on several occasions. So things are starting to move, Richard, and I'm happy about that.
Yes, good.
If you remember, about 3 weeks ago, Richard, we had Dr. Coakley on the program, and he told us about a contingent of his students that was over in Ghana working on a project, and that he would set them up to come on the program to talk about their findings, some of the project work that they were doing on the continent, in Ghana in particular. And we have their representative and her team on the line with us this evening. Ms. Tamia Bathay is an international business senior at the University of Texas at Austin. And her and her group is doing a research project on colorism and specifically the topic of skin bleaching in Ghana. And she's there now and she's with us on the line. Ms. Bathay, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Great. I'm happy to have you on Time for Awakening with myself and Brother Richard.
How you doing, sister?
I'm doing good. I'm really excited to be here.
I'm great. Happy to
my
have
whole team are.
Good. I'm happy to have you on. We kind of had the 11th hour snafu last week, but I'm glad that we were able to do it this week.
Yes.
Before we talk about your work and what you've been doing in Ghana, your team, I think it's four young ladies with you, or three young ladies, and including yourself.
Yes.
Tell us their names and their majors at the University of Texas at Austin.
Yes. There's four students total, and I'm one of them. The other student that's on the team, we have three other students that are on the team. One is Vita Wede, and she's Nigerian-American, and she's an exercise science major. And then we have Rebecca Chen, who's an advertising major, and she's a Taiwanese-American. And then we also have Christina Cho, who's an international and global studies major, and she's Korean-American.
Okay. Ms. Bathay, talk about you. Oh, go ahead, Richard. You want to say something to her?
Oh, no. I'm just trying to make sure I'm got to who's on who's. It's an interesting mix that I like to explore as we go through dialogue around this.
Yeah. Ms. Bathay, as you know, we spoke with Professor Coakley on the program. It might have been a month ago now, and he told us about some of his students and the project that they chose, and talk about what, not necessarily what brought you there. Well, it was interesting that you chose that particular topic. Talk about why you chose that research topic to do on the continent.
Yes, so I'm an African-American woman, and I know that I've struggled with different parts of being an African-American woman and just kind of how we're valued in different spaces. And so talking to a lot of my other fellow African-American women at UT and all of my best friends happen to be darker-skinned women, I learned about kind of the colorist mentality that is in Black communities and kind of within the society as a whole. And so I kind of also transitioned my hair, and I, you know, texturism and how we view texture was a big part of the way that people assert value to a woman as well. And so having all of that in my history and growing up, I became really interested in those topics. And then I learned kind of about skin bleaching through a Grapevine video, and I was like, wow, this is very interesting. And so I wanted to sort of look into the very brutal manifestation of colorism, which is skin bleaching, specifically in Ghana. And me and my team chose Ghana after we tried to kind of go through a list of different African countries that we were wanting to visit, but Ghana happened to be the best option for us.
Okay. Now, as a Richard, go ahead, jump in.
Could the other women express why they? Because you gave a personal experience, and it's a different cultural and ethnic diversity in this team. Mm-hmm. I'm curious of specifically why the others also. Decided to become a part of the team and decided that particular topic resonated with them. You know, before we get the dialogue, Ellie, I just mm-hmm. thought,
yeah, go ahead.
Yeah.
Yes. So I have my teammates here. I think they can best portray that. Is that okay if they come on and say their own? Is that what we're wanting?
Yes.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Okay. Awesome. Awesome. All right. I will brief them. Yeah, so come on and say why you need the potential experience.
Hello.
Yes.
How you doing?
Hi, my name is Vita.
Okay.
Yeah, so I'm Nigerian American. I'm an exercise science major. And similar to a lot of the things Tamia had experienced growing up, I grew up perming my hair. I grew up perming my hair, and I didn't really understand why like that was such a norm and why it was just so common and it was so normal for us to continue to do that. And so just going through the process of kind of understanding for myself like why people were doing that, and like kind of going through the process of transitioning into going back to my natural hair, and kind of even just struggling through that and like why it was so difficult for me to wear my natural hair as it was, and just kind of seeing other people doing it, but just kind of working through that. And also within my family, we're of darker skin, and just kind of seeing the way like my siblings and the friends around me felt about themselves, and just the comments that they would receive about their skin, and the way they struggled with that, even like with comments that my brother would get like growing up, and just kind of seeing like the frustration that he had in dealing with that. And like in my community, I don't see skin bleaching. I know like it exists in the US, but like it's not right there in front of me. But I did see like a lot of self-hatred build up within like my friends and my family, and just kind of watching them struggle through that just also kind of tied me more into wanting to get on board with this project. And for me, and I know for others around me, like we've kind of not completely worked through it, but we've been working through it But what we've even been learning with this project is that a lot of people haven't even gotten to the point of understanding that their issue is there. So, yeah.
Avita, one question before you pass the mic. Did you grow up in Nigeria or here in the United States?
No, I grew up in the United States.
Okay. All right. Okay.
Okay. I'm going to pass it off to Christina.
Okay.
Hello.
Hello, Christina.
How are you doing now?
Hi. Yeah, I'm Christina. So this project means something different to me, as our students are all really different. For me, when I was six, I asked my mom if I could get double eyelid surgery because I hated my eyes. And in South Korea, the plastic surgery industry is crazy big. And girls in middle school and high school are often encouraged by their own families and friends to get double eyelid surgery, which is just the extra crease in your eye to make it bigger. Or like I have cousins who have gotten their nose jobs or gotten their eye surgery. So just being around that, I wanted to look like that because I didn't like how small my eyes were and how they made me look too Asian, quote unquote. And I mean, to the extent of that, like I used to cut out pieces of tape and put them on my eyelids so that I would have those bigger eyes. It made me feel confident. And I guess in a less physical way, I just felt myself in spaces that were where, like I was probably the only Asian or only person of color in the room, feeling like I had to overcompensate myself to be heard or to be seen or, be more charismatic, be more funny so that I could not fall into what they might have seen me as, like a submissive or like bookworm Asian, even though that's not a bad thing at all, but it's just I didn't want to be put in a box. And so I felt myself overcompensating in those moments. And yeah, the color complex has definitely been a healing ground for me. And I'm learning so much more every day.
Okay.
So passing the mic over to Rebecca.
Hello?
Yes, Rebecca.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
Okay.
So my story is a little different from the rest of the team. So my parents are Taiwanese immigrants, and so for them being dark was a social stigma related to class, because if you were dark, it meant that you were doing manual labor, you're out in the sun versus people with jobs that required more education. And for me, thankfully, they didn't really bring these ideologies up with me, or they didn't push these ideologies on me. Growing up, beauty was almost seen as a luxury to be something that was focused on. And for me, this project has really made me realize my own struggles with feeling valued in spaces that I'm not, or feeling valued in spaces because I'm not white, whether that be overcompensating in social circles, similar to Christina, or even what I'm pursuing a job in, like, for example, because I'm in advertising and you don't typically see many Asians in the creative industry. It's usually a stereotypical three of engineer, lawyer, or doctor. And for me, fighting against this model minority myth has been something I've been learning more about in myself. This project is also really important to me because just the power that media plays in it, and being in advertising and seeing how influential advertising is, because it directly pulls from culture and shapes culture by showing what roles people play. And representation is such a powerful thing. And I know personally for me, whenever I see Asian Americans being represented, it encourages me that pursuing a job in this creative field isn't a waste, because it's possible for me to be existing in that environment. And so for this project, showing that you don't need to have lighter skin, bigger eyes, a straighter nose to be seen or appreciated in environment is so important.
Okay.
Thank you for that.
Mm-hmm. So that's the team.
Now, Tamia, And I'm glad that you gave us a little synopsis background of all of the students involved in the project. Now let's talk about your trip there, because I know that it was an eye-opening visit for you, an eye-opening trip. Not the work that you're doing. Before you got to the work, you went to Ghana. Now, being that you grew up in the States, you heard a lot of propaganda in reference to your ancestral home or the continent.
Mm-hmm.
So going to the continent, before you even started working on your project, I know it was an eye-opening experience for you. Talk about the experience that you had just being there, seeing the people, seeing the culture, and knowing that you had ancestral ties there. Talk about that experience for you.
Yes. It's amazing. It still is amazing. We're still here. I'm still soaking up Ghana. I do think it's definitely been something that has been a long time coming for the team, but I do know that for me, being African American and not necessarily, you know, kind of having my ancestral history sort of erased by slavery, it was definitely something where I was like, wow, like, I'm going to be amongst people, I'm going to be amongst ancestors, I'm going to be amongst a place where I come from. And so it's been very eye-opening. I think I definitely realized that I'm African-American culturally. So I'm definitely not Ghanaian in the sense of, like, culture, but I do know that there are so many similarities, of course, right, between African-Americans and Africans. And I do think that just in general, I just loved coming here because I think it gave me a new experience of being in an African country and being able to soak in the history, to be able to soak in the people, and to take that back to the United States and to showcase that. Because African countries are amazing. And I think that the U.S. and so many other entities and different things has, you know, can kind of create this, you know, mantra that Africa is not a great place to be, or that places in countries in Africa are not a great place to be. But I 100% will say, like, even going there, we knew that that was something that was going to be, people were going to be talking to us about. Like, I do feel like even within the African-American community, the way that we view Africans, there's this sort of detachment to our ancestors. And that was something that I was very vigilant about seeking out when I came. I did not want this to just be an experience in Ghana. I wanted to be a spiritual one. So,
well, and I know that you're realizing, and you probably realized it before you went, that detachment that you're talking about all ties in with the research project that you were doing. Mm-hmm. All of those aspects of that detachment all ties in, and I wouldn't say the root of it is colorism, but it all ties in. It's all related. It's all related to the propaganda that our people have been exposed to since we were kidnapped and brought to the shores of the United States.
Yes, sir.
Richard, I think we might be getting a little interference on either your young lady's end or on your end, because I'm getting a little echo. Okay, it stopped. It's good. Okay. Ms. Bethay, talk about now where did your research start? I know that you conducted several interviews with men and women of the community of Chokor, and also at the University of Ghana. Where did your research start? At the University of Ghana with some of the students there?
Yes. So technically I would say our research actually started before we even went to Ghana. We wanted to, this project is sort of multifaceted, and it's not just centered on it's centered like specifically in the international research experience on Ghanaian experiences, through colorism. But we also wanted to look at UT and how women of color at the University of Texas at Austin experience colorism. So we actually started our research the spring semester before we went abroad during the summer. And we did research with Asian American, African American women there, like undergraduate women, and we did qualitative research through interviews with them. And so then after that, we came to Ghana, and that's where we started our research here with undergraduate students at the University of Ghana Lagone, and we've finished with some research from the Chakor community with women and men there, and then did a couple of interviews with some Ghanaian men just to seal it off.
Okay. The question I have in relationship to doing the research, what are you trying to prove?
Yes, so that's a great question. That's something that we've been looking at whenever we're doing our research paper right now, which we're currently, you know, tightening up our draft of it, because we're trying to present research in a way that hasn't been done before. Usually that's why you do a research paper. And I feel like the reason why our team is the way that it, like the makeup that it has, is so important is because we wanted to kind of look at colorism as something that each community of color goes through in their own specific way. And so we kind of wanted to tie in the fact that colorism is usually directly notated with, oh, you think of darker skin versus lighter skin. But we also wanted to bring in the fact that texturism is just as much a part of colorism, and that features or featureism, I don't know if that's technically a word, but the discrimination against features is just a part of colorism as well. And we kind of wanted to showcase that this isn't so many other communities of color in Asian communities of color, Latinx, Middle Eastern, pretty much any people that you can think of. And so our research is trying to prove the point that not only is this a thing that happens, and not only does it manifest in so many different medical ways, whether it be skin bleaching or doing double eyelid surgery or perming your hair, which is already controversial for Black women in the U.S. But it's just sort of like getting people's eyes to open up to the fact that, like, you may be a part of this very pervasive, you know, phenomenon without even knowing that you're, you know, a part of it.
Hey, Elliot, if y'all don't mind, I'm going to push. And I hear, because, and I'm glad that the team is made up in the composition that it is, because it helps us and it may help audience as we go through this to get to some understanding. I get the different approaches that are being used to be like somebody, but I think the elephant in the room, and I don't want to say it, I want to see if y'all came to that conclusion, like, who are we trying to be like when we're dealing with either colorism or dealing with color identity or dealing with eye composition? I mean, there is obviously an archetype that we're trying to, of these different ethnic and national groups are trying to be like. So I'm asking the question, who are we trying to be like that we'll go to the extent of using bleaching cream?
Yes, no, definitely. we're basically trying to be like white people.
Is that difficult to accept that that's the archetype of what all these outcomes are moving to in different geographic areas over different generations, that we're trying to be like white people? Is that difficult as students, as researchers, to wrestle with?
I would say before we actually started our interviews, and I'll speak for myself, I very much kind of had my thoughts about this. Like, you couldn't have told me that certain things weren't colorist, and that, you know, that, you know, this is something that people are trying to be. People are trying to be white. In essence, you're straightening your hair. You're trying to have this hair that's usually with white people. You want to change your eyes, you know, you want to have blue eye contacts. Who has that? You know, white people. And then bleaching of the skin is pretty much as white as it can get, because you're trying to become lighter. And so for me personally, it's never been a problem for me to accept that. What's been my frustration is to see how long it takes for other people to have that realization. I think that It's just from a place of complacency that a lot of people of color are kind of in sometimes. And it's kind of saddening. I know for me, it's been saddening to see, like, people don't connect the dots, to be honest. And so it hasn't necessarily been hard to admit that. I think we've all come to admit that, like, that's kind of why people are doing that is definitely what people are getting at, whether they realize it's to obtain, you know, more jobs, you know, but the end goal is to have that success. You have to be or appear in closer proximity to whiteness. And that's just kind of the bottom line. But definitely throughout our interviews, it's been kind of disheartening for me personally to see that the dots aren't necessarily connecting when it comes to having that realization.
So mm-hmm. I'd like to hear Rebecca, you know, would you say, as you go through this process of your research project, would you say that you would have, in your growing up and in your experience, the whole issue of dark skin, light skin, in relationship to being Taiwanese, that the value is about being close to whiteness? Would you say that you were already aware of it, your family aware? Is this something, understanding, or is this something, a realization that you're through this research project that you're coming to?
Would you mind repeating the question? Sorry, we just handed off the microphone.
Is this something that the question of getting to whiteness, if you agree, that is being Taiwanese, and I think you mentioned that you were, you know, of a darker hue, and amongst the Taiwanese families, this notion of being light skinned or being of a lighter skin is being closer to whiteness. Is this something that is a realization that you're coming to through the research, or something that you were already aware of?
I think for
Are you aware of it? I don't want to be presumptuous.
Aware of, like,
that it's all about getting closer to whiteness.
I think for me at first, not really, because in Taiwan, right, it's a homogenous community, so race isn't exactly factored in it. It's more so like, what is the immediate way to judge things, right? It's like by class. And so I feel like that wasn't necessarily something I realized, but digging more into history, I could see probably, like, through being colonized by the Dutch, that probably had a play into wanting lighter skin. But also, I remember reading in the book, The Color Complex, right? Like, I believe it was in Chinese culture where if you were able to afford makeup, like white makeup, and applying it on your face, that was like a symbol of, like, your class. Like, if you had a whiter, paler face, like, that showed your class.
Okay. All right.
So white, being lighter is closer to a class distinction than a racial distinction, as you're saying.
Yes. I think especially because, like, the proximity to whiteness in Taiwan isn't as close as it is, per se, in America, where it's very, very racially charged. And walking into a room and seeing people of all different colors is, like, an immediate thing that you recognize.
Thank you.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Tamia?
Yes.
You mentioned that in your initial research before you got to Ghana, you had assessments dealing with some of the research that you did here, I guess in the States and some of the other areas, neighboring areas that you traveled to before you went to the continent. And I want to kind of get it correct what you stated, that the people weren't really connecting the dots. Did you say that?
So, yes. So the research that we did in the U.S., talking about the topic of colorism throughout our research questions and in the individual interviews, there was definitely a drastic a stark comparison to when we actually went to Ghana and did did similar questions, but in a different cultural context for Ghanaian women. And so it was just, it's easier to talk about in the U.S. It's easier for, kind of like what Rebecca was saying, for people to get that, you know, whiteness is something that has put up a lot of different obstacles for people and have basically discriminated against people and still does. And we're also in a pretty liberal city, and we're in Austin. So having those interviews with women of color there, Asian and African American, you could tell that, you know, the dots are being connected more than whenever we've been in Ghana and doing the same research questions with them. It's been kind of harder to get to the realization of colonization and how that might have impacted Ghana and how that might influence the way that people believe, like, look at themselves and their skin color.
Mm.
Wow. Okay. Now let's break into some of the research once you got to the continent and started your interviews. Did anything jump out at you right away, especially being in Ghana, seeing the products when you went in stores, falling off the shelves, some of the skin bleaching and some of those other products? Did anything jump out at you in your initial interviews or during the course of your interviews?
So the way that we did our research questions was we tried to do it as unbiased as possible. We didn't prep them on what the topic was. We just wanted to go into the questions about beauty, wellness, and see if whatever questions we asked could sort of derive the conversation naturally. And we have test points to see, like, well, how long does it take them to talk about the issue, and then how long does it take them to kind of connect it to the, like, classism, or why do you think people do, like, skin bleach, basically, is like what we're looking for. And so, yeah, that's definitely been one of the things, has just been realizing how normalized skin bleaching here. I think if you talk to anybody in the U.S., whenever I talked to my parents about this project that I was taking on, I think it was just like, wow, that's crazy. You know, like, people are using bleaching creams, but here in the U.S., it's just like, yeah, this is what happens. You know, it's sort of a very normalized reaction to it. And so I think that definitely surprised me, as well as the amount of advertisements for, not necessarily for skin bleaching creams, but just the perpetual appearance of lighter skinned women all around the country. And, or, like, at least I'm not going to say all around the country, I take that back, but all around the parts of Accra that I was in, no matter where I went or no matter where our team went, we always saw someone who was lighter skin. And if you look at the population of the Ghanaian people where we're at, it doesn't make any sense to have this person up here that literally is probably a small segment of the population. It's just not representative of the actual color that Ghanaian women usually do have. So that was definitely something that popped out to me for sure.
Oh boy. Let me, before
go ahead,
Richard.
I was wondering, so how many questions did the survey compose? And what are the, and you kind of made reference to it, I just want to make sure. So overall, in the interview survey, how many questions were interviewee actually given, and what was the categories of those questions?
I wouldn't necessarily call it a survey. It was definitely more of a one-on-one interview that took place with, like, sort of a research interview that took place with each individual. And I would say there was probably around a good amount, like 20 to 30 questions that were standardized for each interview. So whatever was asked in one interview was pretty much similar throughout all the interviews. And we would just ask follow-up questions based upon your answers. And the categories break down as, like, looking into the topic of color, and so asking about what products do you use, or how's your beauty routine, what do you do, to just try to understand, like, what type of products are they into, are, you know, do they like a specific brand? Is it because of a specific reason? And then sort of slowly getting into the, to, what do you find beautiful? What do you see in your environment? What is, and then we sort of, then we start to ask pointed questions about color. Okay. Well, like who's seen as the most beautiful color in your environment? What do you think about the most beautiful color in your environment? And then we would start to go into, if they still haven't yet brought up the issue of bleaching, we would then start to go into the last section, which is about bleaching. And then we also kind of did the same pattern with hair. So we would ask, okay, like, what do you do for your hair? And then kind of the same similar thing. And then kind of end with the usage, the use of perms and why people are wanting to use perms, if they are. And or if they're trying to be natural, why is that a big thing that's happening in Ghana now?
And if I may, what series of questions did y'all find was the most uncomfortable in those categories?
To be honest, a lot of the questions were uncomfortable. Because I don't know. I would say that these are, I feel like we, and me and our team kind of talked about this, but we're just kind of like talking about this in the U.S. comes so naturally, but also talking about yourself or your family or just kind of the personal nature of things, I think because of our culture, it happens so easily. Whereas asking these questions, we definitely had to really kind of, you know, dig deeper. And, you know, they wouldn't really give more information. They'd be like, oh, so have you, like, what do you think about this? And they'd be like, yes. And we'd be like, okay, we need more questions. But I would say the question that was probably the most uncomfortable, or where usually people kind of got the idea of where our research questions or our research project was going, was like when we asked the question, do you believe that the adverts that you see in the commercials that you see, the skin color that, that have, you know, the woman, do you believe that's representative of your country? And I would say for the interviews that I did, it was definitely a, like that everyone pretty much was like, no. And so that was definitely like something where we kind of wanted to not trip them up, but just try to see like, okay, well, what have you been thinking? And then what are you saying about what's the evidence that you're even specifically explaining for yourself about the issue? You know, by saying that it's not representative of the country, and then also looking to the issue of skin bleaching, how can we connect that together? So I would say that's definitely been the most hard question that we've come across.
You know, Elliot, I see that Ghana put a ban on skin bleaching products. And, you know, I'm wondering as a, you know, and that's recent. And it's interesting that, you know, that y'all are doing this project now, when the nation itself is saying this product, maybe for a lot of different other reasons, they're putting a ban on. So it was just, yeah, just interesting that it's so timely that y'all are there, you know, Elliot. I'm just, you know, kind of curious of how this is working out.
Well, not only Ghana, I think a couple of African countries have put a ban on those products. But what I'm wondering, did you find it difficult to see them in the stores, even though it's a ban? Did you go in the stores and see them on the shelves?
Yes, that was one of our main missions, was sort of to do like some environment research. And we went into one of the malls, and it wasn't really hard to find skin bleaching creams. If you look at our website, thecolorcomplex.com, we've basically showcased kind of the different creams and lotions and skin bleaching, just all these different methods that you can use for topical, like changing of your skin color. And it was astonishing because we were like, okay, we hear that it's still an issue. We feel that it's still an issue, but to come here and to see that there was recently a ban, but you can just walk into a cosmetic store or a pharmacy and easily pick out a skin bleaching product. And actually recently, one of our professors came down and he was like, just let's start doing some questions. Let's act as if we're a customer. And we went in and I asked for a skin bleaching product at a pharmacy, and they helped me buy one. So it's really not something that isn't happening still. And there definitely are products that are readily available for sure. Mm.
Tamia, I don't know whether that that podcast that I sent you was helpful to you and your group. The interview that we did with, and her name slipped right out of my mind.
Sarah Webb, L. Webb.
Yes. I don't know whether that was helpful, some of her findings and assessments and things that she did. But just looking at this subject, I know that you can't really get to the bottom of it unless you look at it from a historical perspective. Mm-hmm. You see that some of the people, even in your group, approach this thing from a choice perspective. That some of their parents or whatever seen this as a maybe a way that they can get a better job or be more mm-hmm. accepted and make a choice to maybe change their eyelids, things of that nature. But mm-hmm. and even now with African Americans, this is a choice. But mm-hmm. I know that you realize it because you mentioned that when you walk around Ghana and then you've seen some people that was of a different complexion, it was really weird. You knew what they had been using.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that was different for our ancestors and unique is that when we were forced here in chattel enslavement, you seen basically what you saw in Ghana. Everybody basically of the same complexion. The mm-hmm. reason that we have all of this and the psychological damage is because what was done during our enslavement, the rape of the of our women, the rape of men, which is never discussed. Then you got all the quadroons, octoroons, all those type of things that that our people started psychologically saying, well, I think it's better for me to be shades lighter, to look more like a European, to be closer to Europeans psychologically, when that really didn't bring any of our people closer to Europeans or to European values. But mm-hmm. that psychological damage is really not apparent to some of our people now. You got a picture on your website of Sammy Sosa, and he's kind of like right now the poster boy of that. Because when Sammy Sosa first started playing with the Cubs, he looked just like me.
Mm-hmm.
But now, I mean, you know, he's smiling. He's every time you look, he's at a photo shoot, and I don't guess he realized how crazy he looks. I mean, he's he's whiter than the average European,
mm-hmm.
and he changed his hair. He changed everything about himself. But if you were to interview him, and I don't know whether he would have had the opportunity or contacted him, I bet you he wouldn't see this as – it would be really weird to interview him, I would assume, because I don't think he would see this as a problem or any type of psychological damage that he suffered. But I'm just curious, in your interviews, especially with students and the people of the community, how did they see this? Did they see this as a problem? I know governmentally they must see it as a problem because they banned some of the products. But how have they been viewing? Because I know you talk with some of the people in your interviews and your group of people that had used these products in Ghana. Am I right?
Yes.
Now, yes, what did the people feel that hadn't used these products, looking at other people that are using them in your interviews? What was their assessment?
Yes. So the people that hadn't used the products that we interviewed were mostly in the population of Ghanaian women, at the University of Ghana. And I would say there is this sort of like just you look sort of it's like a sad or shameful practice to skin bleach. So that's what's very interesting about this subject is that I think skin bleaching does look similar, but also different in different parts of the country. So the way that skin bleaching advertisements look in India, completely different than like subliminal messaging that you would probably get here in Ghana. And I would say that But there's this, like, despite how much people use the skin bleaching creams and everything like that, there's this huge notion of just, like, it's really shameful to do. And so people who don't skin bleach probably look down, like, definitely seem to look down upon it, and would sort of, like, the question that they would ask when, you know, you're like, oh, do you know people who skin bleach? A lot of, most of the interviewees that we were talking to did know someone who skin bleached. And the question that they would ask that was sort of bring up the conversation of, are you using a skin bleaching cream or not, was what cream are you using right now? Because then that's kind of when you can figure out, oh, did they switch creams? Do they know? And then there's so many different aspects of skin bleaching. So, like, some people can be accidentally skin bleaching because they might not know that there's different, you know, things happening, you know, different hydroquinone and chemical agents within that bleaching cream or within the cream that they're using. But yeah, usually I would say that it's just kind of heavily looked down upon by people who don't use skin bleaching creams.
Which, you know, Elliot, you raise an interesting question. I like to see which y'all had discussion about, especially in comparison to here, the interviewees here in the state and there in Ghana, this question about personal choice. So for those here, is using or light being you know, the lighter, doing things that make you more closer to white, as I'm saying in general, but is that considered a personal choice issue, or is there some identification that it is about a value that they're playing out, a broader value that's being played out in relationship to accepting the value, the belief that white is better, and the outcomes of being white, whether it's treating your hair or, you know, dealing with your eyes or whatever, is not because society is projecting that, but more, I am doing this because it's my personal choice of what I like. It does people hear, is there a distinction about personal choice, is what I'm trying to get to.
Yes. That was something that we, I think, came across in our first couple of interviews, is that most of the time we kind of got, you know, whenever we finished our interviews, we would tell them about our project and kind of see what their, like, our interviewees' reactions of it was. And it was, I think throughout the interview, you kind of got the notion that people who bleach, people who don't, you know? So, you know, that there's that, I wouldn't necessarily say excuse, but there's that statement or that, you know, mantra that, okay, people who are going to do it, you know, probably have lower self-esteem, probably have a different, you know, family environment. And unfortunately, like, they're going to be affected by, you know, what's being told to them. Whereas other people, it was sort of like a willpower thing, I felt like, not necessarily personal choice, but I guess personal choice was probably intermingled in that as well, with just, you know, people choose to do it, and the people who don't choose to do it kind of mentality.
And how did y'all, in y'all discussion afterwards, or as y'all, I heard, if I got you right, y'all are right now wrestling with, how do you make a composite in your final paper around this? How are y'all are dealing with that discussion, if at all, of whether this is a socially reinforced ideal that pushes people to purchase skin bleaching creams or do whatever kind of configuration, or now they call it an alteration. Is that something that's socially driven, or is this, as you say, a willpower individual kind of decision making? How are y'all discussion coming out around that?
I think our team's discussion around that, we definitely wanted to come in with a very open mind about why people skin bleach, where does this, you know, impact come from. But we also did a lot of heavy research beforehand to kind of give us a guidance on where to go with our questions. And with the way that our interviews have gone, I would say that we've gotten that notion that it's sort of a choice within the specific environment. But we have, I would say personally, I the way that our conversation is going is that this is something that is sort of just not being taught. Like, I feel like being African-American, you definitely taught about your relationship with white people on an everyday basis. You're basically spoon-fed that. But with Ghanaians being so far away from that existence of whiteness and only seeing it within specific aspects of being in, like, higher education or looking at commercials, they don't necessarily have that context of colonization, even though, you know, you have Elmina and you have Cape Coast Dungeon. But whenever we talked about colonization, that's something that was very distant for them. Like, it happened, you know, and we're moving on. And race was also something that's very weird. So I would definitely say that with the whole notion, is it a choice? I don't think our team believes that. I think that debunks our whole entire project. We definitely believe there are social constraints. The fact that whenever we ask the question about, well, what do people believe about lighter skinned people? And they'd just be like, oh, they're prettier, or they're more beautiful. And we'd be like, well, why is that? And they'd be like, they just are. So, like, not, you know what I mean? Like, not the digging deeper, like, not understanding that, like, you know, if you can't explain something, there's this fed script, you know, that's being given to you, like, day in and day out. Like, fairer people are better. And just not having that realization of that, because there was usually no explanation of why fairer people are better. It was just they are. And so I think that just kind of helped us to realize just how normalized that ideology is. Because I think in America, you probably get like, oh, fairer people are better because, you know, back in the day, you had, you know, field slaves and house slaves, and house slaves would be the one that would be treated better. So, you know, you get that whole notion and be like, so that's why it's happening today, and that's why it's reality. Whereas here, it's just sort of like, they're just better, you know? Or they're just seen as better, or more prettier, or more of value.
Yeah. Can you guys stay over for a little bit longer? Because I know this is I don't know whether it's expensive call or you're connecting over the internet. So I don't. Well, can you stay a little bit longer?
Yes, we can.
Good. We're gonna take a brief break, and when we come back, we'll continue the conversation, and you can get involved too if you have a question or comment for our guests. Ms. Tamia Bethay and her group of students from the University of Texas at Austin. They're doing a research project in Ghana on colorism and the effects of skin bleaching. You can get involved in the conversation by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. Time for an awakening. We'll be right back.
Tuned in to the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts and live program scheduling, visit us on the web at blacktalkradionetwork.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
Hey, did y'all see the stuff I posted on my wall?
Nah, it didn't even show up in my news feed.
Man, I'm done with social media. All the injustice and brutality going around, and it's like they're trying to suppress our voice. We're trying to get the message out there, and you can't even share empowerment and what's going on around the country either.
Mm-mm. Nah, don't be dumb with social media, though. It's a tool, and there is a place where we have a voice. It's a Let's Buy Black 365 social network. You do anything you want on any other social network. Post pictures, videos, status updates, share resources and community news. But on Let's Buy Black 365, it's a platform for us and by us to tell our messages.
Whoa, that's like a digital underground railroad.
What's the name of that site again?
It's letsbuyblack365.com.
Yeah, I heard about that. It's all about networking, and you get points, right?
Yeah, the more you network, post, and share, the more points you get. Plus, you get points for posting pictures, sharing information, attending community events, and inviting others to network with you on the app.
Wow, that's all I need to know. I'm gonna go download that app right now.
Now, better yet, let me invite you so I can get some points. It's all about empowerment and solutions, y'all.
Yeah, that's what's up. I'm all in.
Let's do it. Let's share our stories.
Let's buy black365.com.
Of the story of the young eagle. Perhaps you've heard it. There was once a farmer who had a barnyard of leghorn chickens, white leghorn chickens. And one day a friend of his said, you know, you could make some extra money if you would capture an eagle and show him around and charge admission to see him. And so the farmer said, that's a good idea. And he went out and he captured an eagle. But the eagle was too used to freedom. Too used to freedom and would not be tamed. And he would not hold still. And he fought back. And then his friend said, look, maybe we made a little mistake. Why not use the eggs, the two eggs that this female eagle has laid? And so the farmer said, that's good. And he put the two eggs under a setting hen. And in due time, one of the eggs hatched. And this young eagle came out. He didn't know who he was. So the farmer called him Tom. And he put Tom out with the chickens, and he ran around with the chickens, and he thought he was a chicken, never knowing that he was the king of the birds. And he ran around with the chicken. In due time, he became a little ashamed of his color. See, the other chickens were white, and his feathers were deep bronze. So he put some chicken oil on his feathers, kind of lighten them up a bit. And then he noticed that the feathers on his head stood up while the chicken's feathers laid down. And he was a little ashamed of that, so he tied a silk rag around his head. You know what I'm talking about, don't you? Well, in due time, the other egg hatched. Now, when this other egg hatched, he broke bad when he came on set. Farmer called him Turk. Now, somehow, Turk felt that he didn't belong down there running away from the farm every time he stamped his foot. And one morning, very early, he wandered over to the edge of the barnyard, young Turk did, and he looked up into the sky, and there he saw a speck appear. And the speck got closer and closer and closer, and it got to be the largest bird he had ever seen. Of course, you and I know that it was a full-grown eagle. And the eagle came to rest on a branch right above the barnyard and looked down at young Turk and said, what are you doing down there with those chickens? And young Turk said, why, I am a chicken. He said, no, you're not a chicken. You're an eagle. He said, an eagle? What's an eagle? He said, an eagle is the king of the skies. He said, I want you to spread your wings and flap them and come up here beside me, and I want to rapture your wife. forward. Young Turk said, I can't fly that high. You know chickens can't fly that high. And he said, why, you can fly that high. There's nothing that you can do. Because it's in your blood and in your bone. Spread your wings. He spread his wings. I flapped them and he flapped them and he rose higher and higher. Higher than he'd ever risen before. And he came in on the branch with the old eagle. The eagle says, now settle down here. He said, I want to tell you that your father was a king of the skies. No bird could fly higher nor farther than he could without rest. And your mother was a queen of the skies. She was looked up to and admired by all of the birds of the sky. That's who you are. He said, well, you know, I'm a little ashamed of the color of my feathers. He said, don't you know what that color represents? He said, well, that's royalty. Represents royalty. He said, oh, that makes me feel so good, Turk said. He said, but how about the way the feathers on my head stands up? It's different from the other birds down there, the other chickens. So he said, why, don't you know that's your crown? I said that you were a king. He said, this sounds so good. He said, let's tell Uncle Tom. So he said, Uncle Tom, he called him Uncle Tom in deference to his older years. You know, he was a little older. Uncle Tom, and Uncle Tom was busy running around there with his silk rag on his head and so on. And he said, Uncle Tom, this fellow is telling us who we are. He's giving us our history. So Uncle Tom said, I don't want to hear anything about our history. I'm too busy eating this good food down here. And besides, you better come down here. You'll get us all in trouble. Said, I don't want to hear any history. So the old eagle said, just forget him. He's too brainwashed. Let us fly away to our destiny. And they took off.
From antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening with your host, Brother Elliot. Sundays, 7 p.m., Fridays at 8 p.m. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit us up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. And we're spending time with our special guest this evening, Ms. Tabina Bethay and her group that's doing a research paper on colorism and the specific topic of skin bleaching in Ghana. They're a group out of the University of Texas at Austin. And Mr. Bethay is an international business senior at that same university, along with some of her colleagues in the group. And you can get involved in the conversation, too, by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. Ms. Bethay, you still with us?
Yes, I am.
Good. I think we got a caller here on the line. Let me go to him or him or her. Caller, what's your name? Where you calling from? Caller, are you there? Let's put them back on hold. Maybe they stepped away briefly. Ms. Bethay.
Yes.
Question. Now, because I don't know too much. I mean, I see if I've heard about these products. And I guess you would see them on store shelves if you're looking for them here in the States. Is there any, have you done any cursory research on the health concerns in relation to these products?
Yes, we have.
Go ahead.
We actually have talked to some health professionals, one before we came to Ghana and one while we've been in Ghana, mm-hmm. about the health risk associated with skin bleaching creams or just different things that you can do. But mostly skin bleaching creams, because there are different advancements and ways that you can bleach your skin via pills or injections. But most of the health, most of the, what would you say, accessible usage is done through skin bleaching. And something that we've discussed with a health professional who's Nigerian American, she's a Nigerian American woman, and she has done she's been a doctor in Ghana for some time now, and she sat down and talked with us about just how bad it gets with patients who come in who are skin bleaching. And it's very very common that you'll find that the patient that you're treating the ailment is pretty much related to the issue of skin bleaching. The different things that can happen whenever you skin bleach is that your skin basically is you taking off the top, you know, protective layer of melanin. And the reason why, you know, African people do have a very darker complexion and have a lot of melanin is because of the environment in which they are in. And so it's basically a protective layer against the sun. And when you start taking that off, you basically give yourself over to health risks, such as skin cancer and different ailments that would have protected you if you've had, like, that would have been protected, you would have been protected from if you had the extra melanin on your skin. And so also with other things, you don't heal as quickly. It's harder to stitch you up. It's harder to have surgeries because basically the skin is weakened over time. And usually the patients that they're getting that are coming in have been doing skin bleaching, have been using skin bleaching products for years and years. And so they basically have that, they like it's basically just toxic within their system, as well as different health, you know, risk associated that have to deal with just it being sinking into your bloodstream. That I don't have technical know-how or technological terms about, but we have done some health questions and talked to professionals about that.
So these creams, does it relax the melanin or it destroys the melanin in the person's skin? And when I'm asking that two questions because, for example, just say I'm using skin cream or skin whitener, bleaching, and then I stop. Does the melanin come back or is it destroyed?
Yes. The way that it works is that when you're using these chemical agents, it basically is taking off the melanin. Like, it's taking off that melanin. But over time, like, it's over time, if you stop using the products, your melanin comes back.
Okay.
So okay. It's not a complete destruction of, like, your color. Your melanin actually does come back over time. It just has to be sort of, like, you know, kind of just weaned out of your system.
Okay. All right. Hopefully with some of the people that's doing this, and maybe through some of the contact that you've had with you and the other students involved with the research team, maybe they'll realize that, well, you know, maybe this was a fad, maybe I ought to stop, or maybe they'll listen to some other folks, because if they're causing health concerns and they just using this as a fad or a temporary lifestyle or whatever, you know, I guess all of us reaches a point where, you know, when we know better, we do better. So, you know, maybe they'll stop. You would hope. But I was just curious because I don't know the effects of these products. I know it's changing people's complexions. And I didn't know that if they stopped, whether the complexion would come back or whether it was totally destroyed. So you kind of cleared that up for me.
Yeah, no, going off of your thought about, like, being conscious of it and does that change the way people view or make decisions, I do think that our project, The Color Complex, is really looking at this issue from a psychological standpoint. And because of the fact that there have been a lot of health bans that haven't been necessarily effective in changing people's mind, I think people who do skin bleach, regardless of whether they have, like, direct information, like, they see the side effects other people have, or they see other people in their environment suffering from the issues of skin bleaching, but they will still do it. Sometimes they'll stop, but other times, most of the time, they won't. Because they feel like they have to continue that to maintain their skin tone, which is a phrase that that's very common here in Ghana, which is, like, maintaining the tone that is, like, basically the lightest tone that you can have.
You said that. Go ahead, Richard. Yeah. Go ahead.
You know, I apologize because I might be going off. It's two thoughts that come to mind. Because as we're talking about skin bleaching, I'm thinking about burns. And I was wondering, especially in the States, did y'all get a sense that in the discussion about skin bleaching, that women or your interviewees really
made a correlation between the same side effect between skin bleaching or and getting women, particularly women, it used to be men getting comps, but now it's women that get perms. Did that discussion come up indirectly, the correlation between the two?
Yes. No, that wasn't, it wasn't even an indirect discussion because that's just as much a part of our project. That was something that was like, we have a section for hair. And yes, it came up, but I do think that the people that we interviewed in the U.S. are definitely, they're very, and we're also in Austin, a very liberal city. I think we saw the process that they went through, especially African-American women, when they talked about permed hair. And I would say this, like, whenever you talk to African-Americans about skin bleaching, they are immediately...
Hello? Mm-hmm. No, go ahead.
Yeah, sorry. They're immediately like, aghast. Like, they just cannot believe that this is something that happens. And to be honest, there's a lot of distance that happens. Like, oh, wow, I can't believe these people do this. And wow, I can't, like, not recognizing that the problem is also within our own community. Even though it may not have a manifestation of like skin bleaching, or it may not be as commonly seen. But whenever you think about perming hair, that doesn't typically connect for most people, unless they are women who probably have gone through the natural hair journey, which happens to be a lot more African American women in the environment that I'm in. So most of the women did have that connection of, yeah, this is just another issue of colorism, just as much as dark, having like the stigma of darker skin is, but it definitely isn't like as common. That's why you still see people who will perm their hair, because they believe it's a choice and it's not something that they might have some residual effect from colorism or something like that.
You know, and this is social marketing plays a big role in this, and I guess depending, it doesn't matter what country you're in. So, and you mentioned about the dealing with the psychological aspect of this. How did y'all have a discussion about the social marketing? And since I see Rebecca, was it you that's in advertising? Did you bring, you know, that point of view as y'all are, you know, wrestling with how to pull all this together? The idea that there is some social marketing around this, and I think you mentioned the advertisement and the imagery that is in advertising. So how did y'all give us some snippet of y'all discussion, if any, around that and the impact in relationship to bleaching cream on Canadians and those here in the West?
Yes. So I'm going to preface her in a little bit. Basically, the way that we kind of looked at social marketing was through the use of our literature that we were reading, like through The Color Complex and other articles and scholarly papers and research papers. But we also have a team outside of us, which is our faculty mentors. So the President's Award for Global Learning is the program that's funding us at the University of Texas at Austin. And we have three faculty mentors that are currently teachers there, professors. And so we have our business professor, who is Professor John Doggett. And then we have, of course, you know, our African diaspora psychology professor, which is Dr. Coakley. And then we also have our advertising professor, which is Mamay Drumright. And she basically was the person who it kind of took us through social marketing and kind of helped us to look into those notions. But I know that Dr. Boateng is also our she's also our connection to the University of Ghana Lagoon, and she's another professor that is a part of our project as well, and she's in the School of Social Work. But going back to the social marketing aspect, I'll let Rebecca kind of come in about it and basically just kind of explain like the conversations we might have had about social marketing, and even looking into our campaigns and what we plan to do with social marketing on our own point.
So we actually had a focus group last week where we got a brief three university students over some potential message ideas that we had made based off our insights. So like one of our major findings was how men's perception of women
leave us alone now.
Or just like men's perception of what they find attractive and more beautiful tends to be lighter skin. And so that was one insight. And how we kind of spun that into a potential message idea was focusing on woman empowerment, like kind of finding, like being kind of like a badass woman, like just feeling confident in your own skin. And so that was like one potential message idea. Another one was that Ghana is a very religious country. And so you'll walk around the streets and you'll see like billboards advertising like churches or just colloquial sayings, or even on the back of cars, you'll see it's almost kind of like a car tattoo. It'll be like grace or like a picture of Jesus on the cross. And so one of our potential message ideas was like finding kind of your own confidence rooted in religion, like not trying to like listen to other voices, but kind of rooting yourself in that, like God made you this way and like God made you beautiful and whatnot. Because in our interviews, a lot of the responses we were getting from women was asking them like, hey, like, would you want to change what you look like? And their response is like, no, like, I don't want to, because this is what God gave me. So why would I want to change that? A couple other messages was we found a lot of people kind of using language to disguise what skin bleaching is. And so the way that they would, like, now skin bleaching is known as skin toning because it sounds less harsh. And so therefore a lot of people assume it to be a more natural way to lighten your skin. And so just kind of educating people, like, there isn't a difference. And also kind of getting rid of this idea of like, there is a natural skin color that you need to maintain. Like one way that they'll advertise skin toning is, oh, it's bringing out your natural color, but it's like, how natural can you get?
The augmentation is getting you too natural, but not what you're carrying, right?
Yes. Yeah. So it's like, so kind of re-educating that your skin will change, and the skin that you're born with isn't going to be what your skin is going to look like when you go outside or when you're inside. Like, your skin adapts to different environments. And so that's natural. Like, your natural state of skin is going to change. And then another one we found was educating them on the health risks of skin bleaching, like equating it as skin cancer, because it does make you more susceptible of skin cancer. So those are some of the messages that we presented to them to see kind of which one resonated with them more, like health risks versus like empowerment versus religion.
Okay. Good. If I may, Alex, I wanted to ask, I know, and you see, I'm trying to touch bases with everybody because I like to hear their thoughts. But Christina, yeah, you know, since your family is, you know, from South Korea, and it's this question about physical augmentation, I guess you come to the team, you know, out of that experience. Do you see in that experience in Ghana, as you're dealing with this research project, have you seen any correlation between skin bleaching and any physical augmentation, or heard any feedback from people that not just doing skin bleaching, but trying other physical things to augment themselves. Did you see anything out of your lens from that perspective?
Hi, Elliot. So I would say outside of skin bleaching, we didn't get a lot of information about, or I guess experiences of people augmenting, you know, their face or other parts of their body. We did focus on skin bleaching, but I am aware that, you know, there are like plastic surgery instances in the States and, yeah. So short answer.
The reason I bring that up because, I know, in different countries in the continent, there is a now this wave, and I see it's happening, or it is happening here about, how do you say this in polite discussion? Injections in the, butt injections to make, your butt. So, you know, and it's all, and then that's a different, I don't know if that relates to, you know, our discussion about whiteness, but it does relate to adding some other element to enhance oneself. That's why, you know, I just raised that question. But yeah, I mean, your response was good. I just wanted to see, did you notice anything?
Mm-hmm. I got a question for Vita. Is she present?
Yes, she is. Yes. She's right here.
Vita, some of the assessments that was that you guys came up with in Ghana, is it the same assessments that you now? I don't know whether you've done independent studies in Nigeria, but what is some of the assessments that you've come up with in reference to Nigeria and this topic?
Do you mean as in like the results that we've?
Yeah.
Found?
Did you do anything in relation to Nigerians and how they felt in reference to it? And is this a bigger problem? Or as big a problem in Nigeria as it is, or phenomenon. Some people might not see it as a problem. Is it as big a phenomenon as it is in Nigeria as it is in Ghana?
Yeah. So we actually didn't do any research in Nigeria. We just did research at our university and then research here at the university, research here in Ghana.
Mm-hmm.
But we have, you know, heard from people and talked about it a little bit.
Well, just visually, is it just as big of an issue there?
Skin bleaching is actually bigger in Nigeria. It's a lot more prevalent. And it was actually one of the, so we looked into going to Nigeria when we first started the project, but with the ban that was placed in Ghana, it felt like there was a start to the conversation.
Okay.
Because they were addressing the health hazards of skin bleaching. In Nigeria, it's still extremely prevalent. Like, it hasn't really been touched upon. There's a higher percentage of people in Nigeria that skin bleach for sure. But we, even when we were here, when we would tell people that we're studying, that we're working on a project and we're researching about skin bleaching, they would ask why we didn't go to Nigeria.
Okay.
It's definitely a lot more prevalent there, but we felt that, well, we didn't go there for a few reasons. But one of them was that we felt it would be harder to initiate conversation with people about it because it would most likely be a lot more taboo to even bring up and a lot harder for people to see it as an issue.
It's interesting because, and I'm glad you raised the question, Elliot, and Vivian, that you responded, because the Nigerian women that I see that do, it always is so interesting to me to see how red their skin get and blotchy. And that doesn't seem to be a problem.
What, when they're skin bleaching, Richard?
Yeah, it's because of the skin bleaching. Their skin color becomes rosy red, and in some cases it's blotchy. So, you know, from using the skin, but you know, and they it doesn't seem. And that's only, you know, my personal opinion. But the question that came to my mind, whether in Ghana or, you know, Nigeria, just I don't see a lot of men.
That was my next question. Yeah.
Does men get as much skin bleaching as women do?
I don't think it's as much as women, but we have definitely spoken to men here that skin bleach or were skin bleaching and stopped. And yeah, it's not as much for men, but it does happen. A lot of the, when we talk to the students and we ask about men skin bleaching, they would say that some do, but since the standards, beauty standards are more prevalent among women, so there are higher standards for beauty among women. So for a lot of men, people are looking more at their bodies, like their body types, as opposed to what their skin color is. And even just a few people mentioned it about like skin tone being tied to like femininity and masculinity. So like darker skin tone may be more attractive on men because it makes them look more masculine. And some people don't like lighter skinned men because it's too feminine.
That's interesting. That's the first time I heard that.
Okay. and that was one of the questions that I had for you, Vita, because your origin is from a different country in Africa on the continent, and I wanted to kind of get the dynamic there and how they felt in relation to this phenomenon of skin bleaching and colorism.
Yeah.
Ms. Bethane?
Yes.
Now Vita was saying that in her country it's even more widespread.
Mm-hmm.
Now your assessments of both men and women here in the States and in Ghana, do you see that what is the percentage of men or women as opposed to men that are skin bleaching of just from your cursory assessments?
In Ghana?
No, in both. Just putting it, if you put it all together.
Don't quote me on this, but I would probably say it's most likely 80-20, 80% women, 20% men.
Okay.
Or 70-30, if like a give or take scenario. Because in the studies that we've been collecting with our research and, you know, interviews, also with just our own personal experience of being in Ghana and also being in the U.S., colorism is definitely a very gendered issue. It definitely has this perception of what a woman should look like, what a beautiful woman is, and men are not necessarily always held to those standards of having to showcase themselves through that. For men, it's mostly like power or money, whereas for women, beauty is definitely entangled. And so colorism and looking a specific way is definitely more gendered. And it's an issue that I would say women of color deal with more often than not, than men of color do.
Okay. Now, how much longer will you and the team be in the continent?
We're actually leaving tomorrow at 10:30 p.m. A flight back to Houston, Texas. And we've been here for a little bit over 2 months.
Oh, you've been there quite a while. Okay.
Look, wait a minute. Y'all been there 2 months? Like, I can't get there for 10 days. What? Check this out.
Have you enjoyed the even though you're there to do work and, you know, you've been there a long time, so, you know, even in doing work, I guess you had time to socialize. So for young college students, female students in Ghana, what is the social life to help you with the stress of doing your research? How is the social life of Ghana from taking it out of that? That might be a research question.
The social life is definitely popping. But it's not hard to have a social life in Ghana. Let's just say that. I would say that, to be honest, and we knew this going in, but there's an archetype or like a character or a profile of every culture. And we did profile Ghanaian culture with also the understanding that it's not going to be like this. This is just to like have this initial idea of what we're going to be coming into. But Ghanaian people are so friendly. And they're very heartwarming. It's not hard to make friends. It's definitely not like, you know, a distant or like a culture where you have to like go through so many, you know, different mannerisms or different cultural concepts to sort of create friends. Like, it does not take that long to make them. And so we've definitely had some great times doing, you know, responsible things that my parents are proud of.
Ella, she has to say that, right? She has to. You see how she put that in there? Responsible
things. But I would also say that with the funding of the program, we were able to really take in the culture of not just Accra, Ghana, but we were also able to go to the northern region in Tamale, to go to Moli National Park. We were able to go to Cape Coast, Elmina, and we couldn't have done it without our TA, Stephen. He's a rhetoric graduate student at the University of Texas at Austin. And then the reason why he was so important and integral to our team was because he graduated from the University of Ghana Lagone, and he's Ghanaian. So to have him on our team, he basically opened us up to a whole new, just kind of like the Ghanaian experience. So it was very much so something that we were blessed to have because he was a part of our team as well.
Which I apologize, but it makes me have to ask, okay, for each one of you, what was the favorite food that you liked?
Yes, so the favorite food. I will go first on mine. I would have to say my first love, banku and okra soup. I do love banku and tilapia. Fufu is great, but for some reason, my heart keeps coming back to banku and okra soup. And then I'll let you talk to Vita so she can tell.
Yes, my favorites have definitely been the fruits. Oh my goodness, so great. And also tilapia.
Okay. Who's next? Christina?
Christina.
My favorite foods in Ghana have definitely been banku and tilapia. With pepe, so good.
Okay.
are you familiar with banku?
No.
Okay, no, so banku is, what? It's like a sour dough, I guess is the best way to describe it. It's made with, it's called a swallow? Okay, anyways. But...
So it's like fufu?
Yeah, it's kind of like fufu. It's a little bit more sour and it pairs so nicely with tilapia or okra soup. Yeah, that's my favorite right there. And all the fresh fruit and juices in the medicine.
Okay. Okay. I think we got a caller back on. Caller, are you there? What's your name? Where are you calling from?
Yeah, I'm here.
Yes, go ahead. What's your name?
Yeah, my name is B. I had a few questions for you.
Go ahead. Go ahead, for the young ladies. Right. Not for me, for our guests. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I'm new to the show, so this is my first time tuning into the show. I wanted to know more about you.
Oh, well, I'll put you back on hold because we may spend a little time before we leave there, and then I'll get you back on.
Okay, no problem.
Right. Tamia and the crew, listen, before we leave, because Richard touched on it, but I just want to get your opinion of young men, and I'm talking about your age, there in Ghana, their approaches to you, their way they dealt with you as far as a young lady. Did you notice any differences? Was it any stark differences that you noticed?
About the way that Ghanaian men dealt with us.
Yeah, their interaction. And I'm talking about your age group, not just men in general. Your age group, when they encountered you, did you notice any stark differences in their approaches to you, their conversations with you, how they interacted with you?
Yes. There was definitely some stark differences. I don't really even know how to unpack it all, but I would say that they're a lot more forward about their appreciation, and very fast moving in their intentions of getting to know you. So, and I would also say a little scary, but that's okay. a lot of staring happened, but also I think it's also the fact that we're American women. I think that was definitely something that they knew because we were in an international hostel. And so it was, or just the way that we're dressed, the way that we talk. So I think that also kind of gave this illusion of something that they wanted to kind of approach and get to know, or I guess was different. Whether it be good or bad, I don't really know how to talk about that concept. But yeah, it was definitely very different the way that they approached us.
Okay, I'm just curious. when you get back, what's the next step when you get back as far as, you know, your paper, your presentations? Do you plan to maybe go to other universities and talk about this? What do you intend to do once you get back?
Yes. So, our project is basically a sort of two-part series. We wanted to do research to make sure we heavily rooted in the facts, and that we also didn't want to misinterpret a culture. We didn't want to come in without actually having been in Ghana for a specific amount of time, knowing it, living it, but also understanding that there's no way we could possibly know everything. We're not Ghanaian. And getting their understanding of it to bring back to the U.S. as well as our own understanding of like the U.S. and our issues with colorism. So that way we can then feed it into our social campaigns. So the other part of our project is a social impact portion, which we will be doing in partnership with advertising class in the Moody College at the University of Austin. And we're going to be, which is communications, and we're going to be doing creating social campaigns to sort of help mitigate the issues of colorism in both environments, for women of color at the University of Texas at Austin, and also with undergraduate Ghanaian women here at the University of Ghana Lagoon. And so we don't necessarily know how these campaigns are going to look like, but we're going to, that's kind of the fall that we're looking forward to. We're also doing our research paper. We also hope to kind of get the ball rolling on getting people to look at our project and sort of start a conversation. And we want to move the needle and with the issues of colorism. We want it to not be something where we're readdressing it every 4 to 5 years. We want people to sort of let this be a conversation, to let us talk about the taboos and to sort of break through all of what this is for each individual person and for each minority community.
Okay. Listen, have a safe trip back. And I know you've been in touch with Professor Coakley. Let him know that you were on. He might be listening tonight. And hope once you get back and kind of get settled and start moving forward that you'll reach back out to us. You got the number. You got our contact. You might want to share some other things on the program. So the door is always open to you.
Thank you so much. We really appreciate you giving us the opportunity to be on here. And we had so much fun talking to you about it.
Okay.
I enjoyed it greatly.
Thank you.
Oh, wait a minute. I can't let y'all go. Ellie, I can't let him go. Because you know, I'm a cultural nerd. So what's the music I should get based off of the music that you heard? Who is, as you say, popping?
You know what? I'm going to leave that question to Vita or Cho. What's the music that they should be listening to that's popping?
Uh-oh.
So there's a song that we really like called Zanku by Dope Nation. Mm. What else? I'm a fan of Sarkodie and Kwesi Arthur, Nobody.
Mm. Okay.
You got that, Richard.
Yeah, I'm writing them down. Yes, got to say that, you know, this intergenerational intercommunication has to happen on various levels, the academic, the cultural, the popular, and all, so that we're able to have a conversation, which I enjoyed the conversation with y'all this evening, and I appreciate, you know, the work that you're doing.
And I noticed how Tamia ducked out on that question that you asked, too. Tamia, a question for you before you leave. I know that you're an international business senior at the University of Texas at Austin. Just personally, were you able to do any networking there and maybe build some future alliances? Because, listen, I know that you know that the future of Africans in the diaspora and Africans on the continent, that they need to be linked up culturally, business-wise, and things of that nature. Were you able to do any type of future networking with some of the folks there?
Yes, I would say that was something that we were sort of able to do.
Okay.
I would say it wasn't as easy to, I don't know why I'm being me right now. I think it's because it's kind of late. But we actually were able to get on Ghanaian national television with a talk show host called Moment Tonight. I apologize. And we were able to use that as a platform to talk about our project and to sort of, you know, educate people, but also like just talk about why we're here and get their thoughts on what they thought about our project. And that was definitely an amazing experience because the connection wasn't that hard to make. We met Moomin outside of a grocery store, and we just, our TA Steven just tracked down his car, and he just was like, yeah, sure, let's have you on. They're really good about sort of like sharing the platform so that way people can be better educated. And I do believe that Ghana, in a sense, in the aura of what they're taught, like of the people and the country, they're very much understanding that skin bleaching does have a negative, like it's negative. I don't think most people would say it's a positive. So I do think that was easier. It was easier for us to talk about it on national television, as well as I don't think we've met anybody else per se in Ghana, but part of the tackle of what we're doing is to sort of show that this isn't. Oh, snap. Okay. I'm so sorry. We also met, he's not necessarily Ghanaian, but we met the director of Dark Girls. Do you know the Dark Girls documentary film?
Bill Nunn, I think. Is it Bill Nunn?
Well, we met Chanson.
Okay.
Barry. Yeah, we met Chanson Barry and Dr. Grills, and basically they were interviewing our professor, who is our professor in Ghana at the School of Social Work, Dr. Doris Boateng, and basically she's now a part of the series of Healing, which is the second part series of Dark Girls, and so we also met them, and so that was a really great connection to have. And as you know, the Dark Girls documentary is funded by Oprah, and it was really amazing to talk to the director about our own project and get his thoughts on what is going to be out soon in October, which is his film. And so a part of that, aside from that, from the connections we made here, we also took upon ourselves to reach out to people who are tackling colorism abroad, because we wanted to initiate the fact that, like, this is a social issue. Not only that, there are so many wonderful people who have been tackling this in their own communities and by themselves and finding funding. And it's, we wanted to really just be able to hear from them and get their own perspective of our project, to get advice and to also hopefully collaborate in the future. So we talked to Dark is Beautiful, which is an anti-colorism campaign in India which is created by the Woman of Worth organization. We talked to Dark is Divine, which is created by a Pakistani woman. And then we also talked to Beauty Well, which is created by a Somalian woman. And then, of course, when you brought up the fact that you had done an interview with Sarah L. Webb, I had already known about her from my previous research over colorism.
Okay.
And I actually reached out to her. And we also reached out to another, someone who's also doing some really awesome anti-colorism work with creating books for children to sort of destigmatize skin color and have that be an interaction between parents. And that's Joy T. I cannot remember her last name for some reason. I apologize. But yeah, no, we've been creating those connections because we want to be able to showcase collaboration, hopefully in the future in some form or fashion.
Good. Well, when you reach out, when you connect with Sarah, tell her that you were on. Have you talked with her, or you said you reached out to her?
We've actually talked, and she's really she's really interested in meeting up next week. And by then, we'll be back in Austin, so the time difference shouldn't be such an issue. And so I'm just waiting on a response. But yeah, I definitely will tell her that. I'll send her the link and tell her that we've been on your show, and it's been amazing.
Okay. We'll talk soon. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having us.
What time is it there? About 3 a.m?
It is actually 1, so not too bad.
Yeah, well, go to sleep.
Okay, yes, sir. Have a great night.
All right.
All right, take care now.
Bye.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Richard, it was interesting to talk with the young ladies and get their perspective on what's going on around this issue of colorism and skin bleaching. And how prevalent it is on the continent. I think it's more underground here. And when I say underground, people using it, but you don't know it. You see the results of it, and you kind of speculate what they're doing. But I think there's more overt from what they're saying.
And what they show us is the high value people, like the person you mentioned. I think it was a baseball player,
mm-hmm.
or the Michael Jacksons, or what, you know. And the entertainers who really, and this is I think is an important point coming out of this discussion. As you really made it clear, it's a white supremacist perspective
mm-hmm.
that we're dealing with. I mean, of hundreds of years of creating this here of image and what they're researching and say is saying targeting women. Who are, you know, who are the progenitors of educating the children, you
exactly.
know, in one way or another, of what is of value, you know, when we come to skin color or hair. So, you know, when you look at the cultural war, and how invisible and it is, and how insidious it is to, you know, people are doing it. And as she said, you know, when you get down to it in Ghana and ask, like, why, you know, they don't particularly have an answer, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing that got me was the religious part, because they're not propagating Black Jesuses.
I know it.
Right?
Yeah, you
and
see
that's
what
another part of that social marketing.
You see what happened when that European came over.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's funny when you kind of look, but it's not funny because mm-hmm. they brought that guy in there. But once the Ghanaian government, I guess when it hit social media and they found out that this guy was, I guess he's supposed to be working miracles and whatever, I don't know, rapture. I don't know what they were doing, but they kicked the guy out of the country and arrested the pastors that brought him in. Did you see that?
Yeah.
Now, in fact, I put the initial reaction when he was there, but I think you put the follow-up story when they kicked that guy out of the country and arrested the pastors that brought him in there.
Yeah, it's you know, it's that insidious, and Ghana, like Nigeria, certain parts are heavily religious, you know, Christianized. So these images that reinforce, you know, whether it be by class or even what you need to do in order to position yourself for a good job or something like that. It's all invisible and it comes down making people think that, well, I'm doing this out of my personal choice. You know, it's not a social, I'm not of a part of a social design,
that is directing me to this behavior. You know, it's just, this is what I feel is a good thing to do. And it's just something that we have to deal with, because it's economic consequence. Those companies, I'll bet you none of them are black owned companies that are owning these skin bleaching cleaning.
Oh, yeah. You know that. You know,
black owned or African owned, you know, and the amount of money that's being made, just like the hair care products.
And she mentioned, you know, the story that the products was banned, but she said when they went in the stores, they were basically falling off the shelf. They're still on the shelves. Yeah, so. Richard, we got a little overtime. You want to go a little?
I guess you got a couple calls. A
couple of those calls, yeah. I want to take a few of them. Let's go to, call that was on first. Let's go to, again, brother, what's your name?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Yeah, B.
Bernie?
No, B.
B, okay. How are you, sir?
Hey, I'm good. Yeah, I want to know what was your take on religion?
In what respect?
Any.
Well, that's a broad question, B. If you could be a little more specific.
Like, do you believe in any religion? Like, how do you feel about religion?
Well, I believe in spirituality, which is a little different from religion. I think religions have been, especially the religions that we're familiar with, have been tampered with and man-made. But all of the religions that we see, the popular ones, stem from spiritualities. And the spiritualities stem from the people who first brought the consciousness of an almighty to the people on the face of the earth, which is our ancestors. So if we want to get involved with a religion, it's best to do research, look back at the origins of any spirituality, and then get to the bottom of it. If you look at Christianity, Islam, any of the popular so-called religions, if you look at the origin of them, they stem off the continent of Africa and some type of spiritual beliefs that came off the continent. So it's best to tie yourself in, and this is me personally, you know, whatever a person does with their own beliefs is up to them, as long as they're not propagating hurting other people, proselytizing other people to believe in a way that they believe. Like I said, I'm a spiritual person. I believe in spirituality, which points the finger directly to my ancestors.
Okay,
Richard? Richard?
I'm curious. Say your name again, brother.
B.
B? For it to be a first time, you know, if I understood you right, you know, before being a first time caller and wanting to, you know, I guess, Elliot, you know, as the host of Time for Awakening, that the first question is, what's your religion?
It is a little weird, but I kind of played into what the brother's saying.
And which raises, you know, since, you know, this format is kind of, when we do that, it's kind of free, you know, somewhat free flowing. So it raises the question to me, well, why would that be your first question? You know, and not that I am evading giving an answer, but I'm just curious as getting to know you as much as you're saying you're getting to know us, why religion would be the first question that you would want to raise?
Well, that's my first question, because I'm sure both of you was probably raised Christian. Am I correct?
I wasn't. But
okay. No, and I wasn't either. But go ahead.
So y'all wasn't raised in any religion?
I personally didn't. We wasn't raised in a religion. My father was a Jehovah's Witness. My mother was a Christian, but I was raised with my aunts who were out of the, you know, more Science Temple, but I didn't have to participate in any. So, you know, I had all these ideals. And as Ellie said, it really directed me to look at African spiritual belief systems from a historical perspective.
But you, again, you raised it as
humor, B. Just assume that I was raised as a Christian. What? Right. Go a little deeper. What does that have to do with why you asked?
Well, say that again.
Humor me, B. Assume that I was raised as a Christian. What does that have to do with what you asked?
No, y'all asked. Why was that? The first question I asked about religion. Most people, you know, grew up in the church or Islam, stuff like that. That's what I was just asking. I just wanted to know your background.
Okay, but you said I assume that you grew up as Christian. So I guess that was the basis of the question. Again, why ask the question? Assume I did grow up as a Christian. Why did you ask that question?
Okay. Well, I want to know how you got from, the other brother said he didn't really come from any religion, but go from religion into African spirituality.
Well, B, what were you raised as?
Well, my father is a Hebrew Israelite.
Okay. What about your mother?
I guess Christian.
Okay. In your research of either one of those beliefs, do you find a intersecting point? A point of commonality? Do you see any point where they kind of intersect with one another?
I don't understand your question.
Okay, you said that your mother was a Christian and your father was Hebrew, right? In your research of those beliefs, I don't know whether you've done research in those beliefs. Some people just believe in any religion. Right. They just believe. They don't do any research, any critical questions. They don't ask. In fact, some religions discourage you from asking critical questions. But I'm assuming that you've done some research in both of the beliefs of your parents. Do you notice any intersecting point of either one of those beliefs? And if you have, where did it seem to intersect at?
You mean where does the beliefs intersect at?
Yes.
Well, I kind of find both to be sort of different other than them using the same book.
Well, let me help you a little bit. That's one of them, the use of the same book. But let me help you. You said that your mother was raised as a Christian. Now, if you notice, a lot of Christians, they just basically use the New Testament. They don't really use the Old Testament of the Bible. When you talk about the Christ or Jesus, as he's popularly known as Yeshua, his growing up, when it was, according to the text, when it was persecution in his home, you know where they went to, right? Or do you know?
Where Christ went to?
Yes.
Egypt.
And he stayed there for, according to the text, 12 years, right?
Right.
All right. Now, put that on the table. Push that aside. You said that your father was Hebrew. A lot of the points, because you know that according to the text, Abraham, Isaac, or Jacob weren't Israelites. There was no Israel then. And you know where they dwelled, if you read the text, according to the text, where Abraham ventured at long before there was any land of Israel. But if you're talking about Moses, who they kind of hang the hat on, you see where Moses was reared and taught, right?
All right.
And the things he taught the people, according to the text, he acquired them at Mount Sinai. But if you ask the critical question about his rearing and origin, according to the text, he grew up with Pharaoh's daughter, and it was certain things, whether you term it the negative confessions or the 42 laws of Maat, certain things that he learned, which are directly contained in the Ten Commandments, you see the intersecting points. That's why I'm talking about it's good to ask the critical questions and get to the bottom of any religions. You mentioned that your mother was a Christian. I think we get a little conversation in the background. Yeah, no problem. We'll fight through it. If you're talking about the intersecting points, if you're talking about Christianity, if you're talking about Jesus or the Christ being raised in Egypt, and I think the text says he was among elders asking questions and learning or something to that nature. I'm quite sure you read it. Right. So you can see where his formulating years, his understanding was being derived from. So when he went back to the land where he was born, he was ready to get out there and do work. The same thing with Moses. Moses was raised in an area, exposed to education. According to the text, he learned from some of the best scholars there. And then he was ready to do, quote unquote, work. So it's intersecting points between both of those beliefs. It's best that, and I'm not saying that anybody can believe what they want, but if they really want to ask the critical questions, and according to the text, if you're talking about the New Testament, Christ told the people, know the truth, and the truth shall set you free. So it's best to know the truth, not just have a belief. A belief is good, and some people have faith and a belief. But it's best to go on to basically what the text says, if you're going on the Bible, know the truth. Both of those men seem to be an intersecting point to where they were at. And this is thousands of years apart. If you're talking about the existence of a Yeshua or a Christ and the existence of a Moses, this is a thousand years or thousands of years span between either one of them men, and they seem to be learning in the same place. So it's something there in the origin of their learning that goes directly to their ancestors and what they were being taught and what they taught. So it doesn't really matter to, especially our people here, what they claim to believe. But I think they need to do a little research in what they claim to believe so they can get a little closer to the quote-unquote truth.
Okay, so do you believe the Bible?
I don't believe all of the Bible, no. No. The Bible has been tampered with, that's clear. But we don't have to have a philosophical discussion on here. I hope I answered your question, B.
Yeah. So as far as Africa, like, what do you are you like? Pan-African, Kemetic?
Well, I'll tell you what, B. I want you to go to timeforanawakening.com. There's plenty of podcasts there. We've had historians there that speak on these issues. Check out some of the historians that have been on, the questions that have been asked by the hosts, myself and Brother Richard, and I think you'll see some podcasts of my former host that I had, Brother Reggie. Check out some of the questions that was asked. Check out some of the men that have done research. And I'm not talking about men that haven't done any research, that have temples, churches, pastors, imams, whatever, that just have a faith and belief. Some of these men have done critical research, and check out some of the things that they've said. Check out the questions that we've asked. After you check out some of these things, then you'll come back with a better understanding of probably what truth is and how I see it. Because just us having conversation here, that's not conducive to being on the radio. Please check out some of the podcasts and then call again. Because I'd like to get your assessments once you've heard some of these things. All right, B?
Okay.
Thank you, sir. That's timeforanawakening.com. Look at some of the podcasts. In fact, you can go on YouTube also and type on Time for an Awakening. Because some of the historians, I've posted some of their work on YouTube also. Check out some of the subject matter. Check out some of the things they said. Thank you, brother.
Okay.
Peace. Richard, let's grab one more, a few more minutes here. Let's go to 215. 215?
Hey, Brother Elliot.
Hey, sir.
Hi, Brother Richard.
Hey, what's up, man?
How y'all brothers doing tonight?
Good.
God, praise be to Allah. You know, Elliot and Richard, first let me say to Brother B that just called. Welcome, Brother B, to Time for an Awakening. Brother B, spread the word about the show. You know, get all your family, your friends, Brother B, and get them to tune in, too. because you know, we have an excellent show here, and we want to welcome you to the Time from the Waking the Family. And I enjoyed your conversation with him, Brother Elliot. And like you said, you told him to go to the podcast and check out some of the other shows that dealt with religion and spirituality. That way, like you said to Brother B, he'll come back with a clear understanding. Now, the sisters that you had on, Elliot and Richard, how many was it two or three sister girls, women? It was one was Asian, correct?
I think two of them were of Asian origin. Yes, two of them.
And one of them was from Nigeria or Ghana. Or
yeah, she was from Nigeria. Her parents were from Nigeria.
And now was both Asian girls was both of them darker skin Asian girls or lighter skin? Because I couldn't quite remember that part.
One of them was darker skin. Yeah.
And the other Rebecca was from light. Taiwan. Her family from Taiwan.
And the other one was lighter skin.
Yeah, well, she was
from South Korea.
Yeah, like a Korean complexion.
Yeah, and so she shows like that is very stimulating because, like, I listen to the show and they very three beautiful young ladies, very intelligent. I really enjoyed it and stuff. They give me hope for the future because, as I was listening, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard, and for the Time from the Waking listener audience, they listen nationwide and I dare say worldwide because. One thing I know for sure, Elliot and Richard, we have to be honest. We all have been damaged by this thing that they call white supremacy. Because I'll say these couple of things and I'll get off and stuff before I talk about the shootings that happened in Texas and Ohio. See, as like I said, I've said this many times, Elliot, on terrestrial radio and stuff. I even said on y'all's show before. When I was growing up as a young child in North Philadelphia, to show you how white supremacy how it gets into your subconsciousness. As a young man watching the Long Range and Tarzan and all those things, especially Tarzan, I would be rooting for Johnny Weissmuller, who played Tarzan at the time. I said, Tarzan, kill them black savages. And I was, hey, I'm a 9, 10, 11, 12-year-old boy. I'm ignorant, not even realizing. I'm telling this white or somebody Richard and Elliot, they look like me. You understand me? I said, kill them jungle bunnies because I didn't know no better. And see, this is what white supremacy has you hating your own people. So I was ashamed as I got older and I started getting more wiser and more mature. I started realizing how ignorant I was by rooting for this European man to kill and malign people that look just like me, you know? And then you go up, you go back to our famous shining black prince, El Hajj Malik Shabazz, better known to most people as Malcolm X. Malcolm said in his autobiography, he said he became a student of Elijah Muhammad when he taught him how to love himself. He said he was ashamed at the foolishness that he did as an ignorant young black man being a pimp. He said he would take straightening combs, Ella and Richard, and that's why I wish I had a chance to say this to the sister. They probably already know because they're intelligent women. But the point I'm saying is that Malcolm said he would take straightening combs and burn his scalp. Ellen Richard burned his scalp because he's wanting to get his hair, the so-called texture of white people's hair, the so-called good hair, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And it's the kind of subliminal damages that white supremacy does to our people, the skin bleaching, like you talked about the baseball player, Sammy Sosa, handsome black man, was born with beautiful skin, man. You know, I'm not no sissy, but I'm just saying, giving the man respect and stuff. I mean, he's a handsome brother. He's blessed with beautiful features. He go bleaches his skin, looking like some kind of space creature, you know, Michael Jackson situation. I mean, all this subliminal stuff that fosters some hatred. And this is what the spectre of white supremacy does. I mean, even with the our own race, thank God it's not what it used to be back in the day in some of the black churches here in Philadelphia. If you was a darker skinned sister brother, you had to sit in the back of the church. If you got in the church at all, you had to sit in the back of the church. You know, if you was a lighter skinned sister brother, you was allowed to sit in the front of the church. Mr. Cain, all this is all a direct result, no matter how you cut and slice it, it's a direct result of white supremacy. White supremacy, this white man's or white woman's standard of beauty. And see, Europeans, as you know, Ellen Richard, they have such a arrogance about themselves that they think because they think a white woman is beautiful, they think the whole world is supposed to think they are, and the whole world don't feel that way. I'm not going to take, if a white woman is attractive by any man's eyes, whether he's a black man, white man, Puerto Rican, whatever, that's fine. I mean, everybody had their beliefs on who was handsome, who was pretty, who was, you know, whatever. But the point I'm saying is that their arrogance knows no boundaries, so they think because their standard of beauty is a blonde haired white woman with blue eyes. They think the whole world's supposed to feel that way. See, this is what white supremacy does. And that's why I have those young ladies on there, Elliot, was a refresher because, and Richard, because they let our people know that you got three young people, two of Asian descent, one of African descent, that got some sense and know what the damage is, what white supremacy has done, from skin bleaching to hair straightening, perm and whatever, the damage is done. And when you have people that honestly can assess that, it gives us a hope for the future moving forward, where we can deal with these kind of, you know, self-hate things that foster self-hatred and mistrust and dislike among our culture. So I thank you, Brother Elliot and Richard, for having those three young ladies on, because it was very refreshing, man. Because this is a good counter of dealing with white supremacy. You don't have to pick up no gun, no bomb. You can deal with it from an intellectual standpoint. That's how you beat back white supremacy. You can beat them at their own game, but they destroy their propaganda.
Richard and Joe, you notice... Richard, I don't know whether Joe heard the whole conversation. You notice, Richard, when the young lady came on that was of Taiwanese descent, and she said she was a dark Taiwanese,
mm-hmm.
and said that some of the people there use skin bleaching because to be a dark Taiwanese, that equates you with working in the field,
mm-hmm.
or doing menial work. Did you catch that, Richard?
Oh yeah,
I heard her comment.
Yeah,
because that's it. See, that points out, Brother Elliot, again, how white supremacy has affected the whole world. You know what I'm saying? And this is why, like I said, I can't thank y'all two brothers enough for having those three young ladies on, because they made me proud. They, as a 58-year-old black man, they just turned 58. I'm turning to an old geezer, turned 58 this past Monday. It gives me a ray of hope and stuff, man, because, you know, this is what we need, people like this, young people that's conscious to take our people forward and stuff like that. You know what I mean? Because remember, I always called the black man and black woman. He said, we are the Asiatic black men and black women of the world. So it's that connection is right there anyway, you know. But anyway, because, you know, you go to China right now, you see some Chinese people, if you didn't know no better, you know, they look like a sister brother walking down the street, but they just happen to be a Chinese, but they dark skin. They got the same complexion that me, I might have, Elliot, you, or Brother Richard might have. They just happen to be Chinese. I mean, because the rapping professor, Aaron Smithson, who went to China, he saw dark-skinned sisters and brothers that was actually 100% Chinese. They was of a darker Chinese here, you know? So, I mean, we everywhere. We in India. I mean, the black man and black woman is everywhere. We in China. We in England. We everywhere in this world, man. So it must be something to that. But anyway, I'll say this and get off real quick so y'all can, you know, get to somebody else to close the show. Now, on this situation with these shooters, right? Again, you see two white male shooters, right? 121, 124, one the coward in Ohio got gunned down by the police and stuff like that. But you see clearly this rise of white hatred, white nationalism, white violence among these white boys. And this is why I say time and time again, if the dimwit loses next year, and I said this to Rest the Radio earlier today, I don't want to say this to be like the sky's falling Chicken Little. I say this as a black man and know the people and the mindset of what we're dealing with. If Trump loses next November, by some way he loses, which I guess could go either way, but if he by chance loses, my advice, Richard and Ellen, to the top of Wicked List is for black folks. You seen what happened at the mall in Texas, and you seen what happened at the nightclub, I think, and by the way, the white boy that shot the place in Dayton, Ohio, he killed his own sister, because from the word is out that his sister was dating a black man, so he killed her. And he killed the black man. Hasn't been confirmed yet, but that's the rumor that's out there, which wouldn't surprise me, because he dealt with irrational, sick people anyway. But the point I'm saying is that if this guy loses next year, my advice for black folks and people of color, don't be around white people. It's not no hatred thing. It's just reality. It wouldn't be wise to be around white people in these big malls or amusement parks, wherever large gathering of white people at, because you don't know these disgruntled white people. They're upset about the dimwit losing. You don't know what they might do. Some disgruntled white man or disgruntled white woman may pull out an AK-40 and start blasting people of color. So my advice is to stay away from them places for at least a good year until things maybe simmer down a little bit, because you know, for some people that's irrational, immoral, amoral. So just for your safety, for for black people and people of color safety, it would be wise that don't be at these places and stuff for at least a good year, if not longer, if this guy loses next November, because the mindset is there. And lastly, Elliot, like I said about Israel, when y'all had the discussion last with these black politicians, see, again, I think I got to give credit to Brother Otis if he lives, because I think Brother Otis first brought it to the table sometime last year. The documentary, Brother Richard and Brother Ellen, and for the time for the wicked listen on this to watch, is that called The Occupation of the American Mind. It got well notables on there like Noam Chomsky, who happened to be Jewish, but he's a fierce critic of Israel, you know, and people like the highly intellectual white men and stuff on there, and women and people of color, this part of his documentary. And if you watch it, it shows you just why the whole for lack of a better word, Ellen Richard, the total domination that Israel has over the United States Senate, Congress, and our black elected officials. If you watch that documentary, the brainwashing, the propaganda, the coercion, the threats. I mean, these people, I mean, it's a sad commentary. And this is why, moving forward, we have got to, Ellen Richard, hold our black elected officials accountable, whether it's on the city, because you're talking about the BDS thing, with the ones like the Jordan Harris's here in Pennsylvania. You got to hold these Negroes accountable and let them know, we did not elect you to be a state senator from Pennsylvania. We did not elect you to be a mayor or city council person from Philadelphia. We didn't elect you to be a congressman or a senator from Pennsylvania to represent Israel's interests. We represent you to represent the interests of black people. So damn it, if you don't want to represent your black people, I suggest to the Jordan Harris, the Dwight Evans of the world, and Elijah Cummings, then all you got to do, Elliot, is just renounce your citizenship and move to Israel and run for the Israeli Knesset. You ain't got a Knesset over in Israel. If you want to then go over to Israel and be a representative in the Israeli Knesset. Don't sit there and play black people for stupid publicly. And you sitting there taking money from AIPAC and turn the blind eye to Israelis occupation and their mistreatment and brutal humane treatment of our Palestinians. Sit back here and throw Minister Farrakhan to the world again. To be a true supporter of Israel, then resign your office and go over to Israel and run for the Israeli Knesset. That's up, Wally. You know, you can't have it both ways. You can't serve two masters at one time. Either you for black folks or you for the Zionists. It can't be both, you know?
I understand.
Something with that, bro. I can't make it no one play. Malcolm say, make it plain. I try to make it plain, brother. You know? But anyway, and like I said, in closing, Wally, again, watch how the white media portray these two white boys. They sick. Oh, they was lonely. You know, they might have been, you know, they might have been, came from a bad household. Or they was just angry white men. They felt bad because they couldn't get into college, maybe because a black person kept them from getting into college. The white women, rich white people just got caught in this big college cheating scandal just a few months ago. But hey, you know the old saying, Ellen Richard, if you're a white man in this country and you can't make it, in this country, with all the laws favor, you got the police that favor you, won't shoot you down if you're shooting at them and stuff most of the time. You know, you got everything favored for you. So if you're a white man in this country, you can't make it. You must be a real loser. Mm-hmm. You must be a real loser because everything is in your favor. Stats show, Ellie, not just my last point, I promise I get off. Stats show that an uneducated white boy, high school dropout, can go to a bank. This has been proven. And here, a black man or woman could be highly educated, have A1 credit, 850 scoring credit, and yet the white high school dropout can go to a bank and get a better loan than somebody got, a black man or woman that's highly educated, got good credit. So again, if you're a white boy in this society and you can't make it with all the laws in your favor, you're a loser. Simple as that. But thanks, Ellen Richard. God bless. Yeah. Take care.
All right, now.
All right, peace. Mm-hmm.
Richard, we come up to the end of another program. Give the lineup.
Yes,
tomorrow, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, African Perspectives with Brother Oshie. Always interesting dialogue on African Perspectives with Brother Oshie. That's 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. After the program on Mondays and Wednesdays from 1 to 3, Black People's Matrix with Brother Franklin Jones. From 6 to 8, Acres of Diamonds with Brother Jihad Ahmed. And from 9 to 10 on the first and third Monday of every month, Conversation Reparations, the NCOBRA program, is on Mondays from 9 to 10. And from 10 to 12, Warren Valentine program is on. And that's Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. Warren was on vacation last week, so he didn't do live programming, but his live programming starts up again tomorrow from 10 to 12 on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. On Tuesday from 8 to 10, Black Reality Think Tank with Dr. William Rogers. That's 8 to 10 on Time for an Awakening Media. On Wednesday, 8 to 10, Revive with Sister POC. That's from 8 to 10 on Time for an Awakening Media. On Thursday, 7 to 8, Relationships with Joy and Troy. And then on Friday, Time for Awakening is back from 8 to 10 on Time for an Awakening Media. I want to thank everybody for listening to the program this evening. Lively discussion, as always, and we'll be back on Friday, Lord willing, to continue on this path towards an awakening. Peace.
Peace.
If you're driving through the country on a lazy afternoon, you're watching your children playing after school, they seem to be so unaware. I know the things that they'll soon have to take. Children, soon it will be their turn to try and save the world. Right now they seem to play such a small part of. Children.